8. Stop. I guess there's something to be said for launching the old way, riding 3,000 tons of high explosive on a tower of fire. Dangerous, but dramatic. When we took off, it was sort of like an elevator ride. We were all strapped into our seats, probably just to keep us from wandering around. The tug above us made a whiny little noise, and there was a slight bump, and the platform below us slowly fell away. In a few seconds, you could see the big energy farm. I strained at the seatbelt, but couldn't get close enough to the window to see the laser and the mirror. Dumb of me. It wasn't really a window. If the camera wasn't pointed at the laser, I wouldn't see it. The noise stopped, and there was another bump.
"Switching over," Dr. Porter said over the intercom,
a woman of few words. The main motors were much smoother. There was a slight press of acceleration and a low hum, and in a couple of minutes we were up to our cruising speed, about 250 miles per hour. After a couple of minutes more of going straight up, we were higher than most airplanes, and you could easily see the curvature of the Earth as the Galapagos came into sight. My ears started to pop and crackle with the air pressure dropping. Upstairs, a couple of the younger kids were crying. Ears or fears? It wasn't really anything new. We'd sat through a 12-hour test of it at the Denver orientation. Thin air with beefed-up oxygen, and everybody managed to live with it. We'll be breathing something like this for the next 5 years. The high oxygen content was why we couldn't bring regular clothes. Everything has to be absolutely non-flammable, and smokers have to quit. Little numbers in the corner of the window showed how high we were and what the gravity was. At 7 or 8 miles, the edge of South America was coming into view. The sky was getting darker and darker blue, and by 25 miles it was almost black. You could see a few stars, at least on this side. I craned my neck to see the windows behind me. The ones facing the afternoon sun were dimmed. Soon the sky was inky black, and I shivered involuntarily. For all practical purposes, we were in outer space. Outside the elevator, you wouldn't live a minute. That would be true in an airplane, too. I told myself not to panic. I considered taking one of the pills, but instead just closed my eyes and took a few deep breaths. When I opened my eyes, the gravity had fallen to 0.99. I'd lost a pound already, on the space elevator diet. Money-back guarantee! In 1 week, your weight problem will be gone! That was one advantage we had over the old astronauts. They went straight from 1G to nothing, and about half of them got sick. We had a week to get used to it gradually, but we did have barf bags, too. That made me glance down to the pocket on the side of the chair. I did not count the number of bags in the stack, but rather pulled out the magazines. We didn't get paper magazines at home, except for occasional catalogs. These felt funny, kind of heavy and slippery. I guess that was like the clothes, non-flammable paper. One was the Space Elevator News, with a sticker on it that said, "Take this copy home with you." Not to Mars, I think. The others were the weekend edition of the International Herald Tribune, which I'd read back at the hotel, for the comics, Time, International Photography, and 17.
"God, you're reading a magazine?" Card said. "Look, South America!"
"I saw it miles ago," I said, "but Earth really was starting to look like a planet, and we were only 30 miles up. I'd thought it would take a lot longer than that."
"You're free to unbelt now and walk around the carrier," Dr. Porter said. "Sometime before 6 o'clock, check off your dinner preference and I'll call for you when it's ready."
Doctor, chef, and waitress all in one. impressive. Though I suspected there wouldn't be much chefing involved, and I was right. Once you got over the novelty of seeing the earth out there, it was kind of like watching grass grow. I mean, it wasn't like low Earth orbit, where the real estate rolls along underneath you, constantly changing. I figured I could check it out once an hour, and tried the keyboard. It worked pretty much like the console at home. Bigger picture and more detail. Out of curiosity, I typed in a request for porn, and got an alphabetical menu that was a little daunting. I knew that Card would get access denied, which made me feel mature and privileged. He'd probably devise a workaround in a couple of hours, but he could have it. I don't really get porn. After the first couple of times, it sort of looks like biology. There were a couple of thousand video and virtual channels, but unlike home, the console didn't know what I liked. There was no suggest button, but I could GooWiki anything. The word menu started blinking in the corner of the screen, so I clicked on it. There were 12 standard choices for dinner, mostly American and Italian, with one Chinese and one Indian. Then there were 10 premium meals with wine, which had surcharges from $40 to $250. Some of them were French things I'd never even heard of. I clicked on beef stew, safe enough, and wondered whether Dad was going to rack up a huge bill ordering French stuff made of unspeakable parts of various animals. Mother would probably rein him in, but they both liked wine. There goes the family fortune. You could toggle and zoom the window. I put the crosshairs on Puerto Villamil and cranked it up to 250 times, the maximum. The image wobbled and vibrated, but then cleared up. I could see our hotel, and people walking around, the size of ants. With careful toggling, I found the rocky beach where I'd spent my last time actually alone. "Hey," said a voice behind me. "That's where we met?" It was the pilot, of course, Paul Collins, crouching down so he could see what was on my screen. Was that impolite? "Yeah, where you nailed that iguana with a rock. Or am I imagining things?" "No, your memory is perfect. I wondered if you wanted to play some cards. We're getting a game together before anyone else claims the table upstairs." I was flattered and a little nervous that he had come down to find me. "Sure, if I know the game." "Poker, just for pennies." "Okay, I could do that." The kids in high school had stopped playing poker with me because I always won, and they couldn't figure out how I was cheating. I wouldn't tell them my secret, which was no secret. Fold unless you have something good. Most of the other kids just stayed in the game, trusting their luck, hoping to improve their hands at the last minute. "That's idiotic," my Uncle Bert taught me. "Only one person is going to win. Make it be you, or be gone." I got my purse out of the little suitcase and glanced at Card. He was wrapped up in a game or something, virtual headset on. Mental note: that way, nobody can sneak up behind you and see what you're doing. Upstairs, there were 5 people at the table, including Dad.
"Uh-oh," he said. "Might as well just give her the money."
"Come on, Dad, I don't always win." He laughed.
"Just when I'm in the game."
He actually was a pretty bad poker player, not too logical for an engineer, but he played for fun, not money. We spent a pleasant couple of hours playing Texas Hold'em and 7-card stud. I dealt 5-card stud a couple of times, the purest game, but that wasn't enough action for most of them. Dad was way ahead when I left, which was both satisfying and annoying. I learned that Pilot Paul plays pretty much like me, close to the chest. If he stayed in, he had something. Or he bluffed so well, no one found out. I went in with $10 and left with $20. That's another thing Uncle Bert taught me. Decide before you sit down how much you're going to win or lose, and stop playing at that point, no matter how long you've been in the game. You may not make any friends if you win the first two hands and leave. But poker's not about making friends, he said. The gravity was down to 0.95 when I went back to my chair, and I could almost tell the difference. It was a funny feeling, like, where did I leave my purse? I could just see North America coming up over the edge of the world. Zoomed in on Mexico City, a huge sprawl of places you probably wouldn't like to visit without an armed guard. Card was still in virtual, doing something with aliens or busty blondes. I put on the helmet myself and chinned through some of the menu. Nothing that really fascinated me. Curious, I spent a few minutes in Roman games, Caligula, but it was loud and gory beyond belief. Settled into midnight warm ocean calm, and set the timer for 6, then watched the southern sky, the beautiful cross and Magellanic clouds, roll left and right as the small boat bobbed in the current. I fell asleep for what seemed like about 1 second, and the chime went off. I unlocked the helmet and instantly wished I was back on the calm sea. Someone had heard the dinner bell and puked. They couldn't wait for 0G? There went my appetite. After a few minutes, there was a double chime from the monitor and a little food icon, a plate with wavy lines of steam, started blinking in the corner. I went upstairs to get it, hoping I could eat up there. I was the second person up the ladder, and there was a short line forming behind me. They said they would call 10 people at a time for dinner, I guess at random. There were 10 white plastic boxes on the galley table, with our seat numbers. I grabbed mine and snagged a place at the center table, across from the rich kid, Barry. He had the same thing I did, a plate with depressions for beef stew with a hard biscuit, a stack of small cooked carrots, and a pile of peas, all under plastic. Everything was hot in the middle and cool on the outside.
I guess we can say goodbye to normal food, he said,
and I wondered what dinner normally was to him. Linen and crystal, sumptuous gourmet food dished out by servants.
Water boils at 170 degrees at this pressure, he continued. It doesn't get hot enough to cook things properly.
Yeah, I read about coffee and tea. All instant and tepid. The stew was kind of chewy and dry. The carrots glowed radioactively, and the peas were a lurid bright green and tasted half raw. Funny, the peas started to roll around on their own. A couple jumped off the plate. There was a low moan that seemed to come from everywhere.
What the hell?
Barry said, and started to stand up.
Please remain seated,
Dr. Porter shouted over the sound. The floor and walls were vibrating.
If you're not in your assigned seat, don't return to it until the climber stops.
Stops? He said. What are we stopping for?
Probably not to pick up new passengers, I said, but my voice cracked with fear. Dr. Porter was standing with her feet in stirrup-like restraints, her head inside a VR helmet, her hands on controls.
There isn't any danger, her muffled voice said. The climber will stop for a short time while the ribbon repair vehicle separates to repair a micrometeorite hole.
That was the squat machine on top of the climber. It separated with a clang and a lurch. We swayed a little. I swallowed hard. So we were stuck here until that thing stitched up the hole in the tape. If it broke, we'd shortly become a meteorite ourselves. Or a meteor, technically, if we burned up before we hit the ground.
I heard it happens about every third or fourth flight, Barry said.
I'd read that too, but it hadn't occurred to me that it would be scary. Stop, repair the track, move on. I swallowed again and shook my head hard. Two children were crying, and someone was retching.
Are you all right?
Barry asked, a quaver in his voice.
Will be,
I said through clenched teeth.
How about them gators?
What? Are you insane?
You said you live in Gainesville, he said defensively. don't follow football. An admission that could get me burned at the stake in some quarters.
Me neither.
He paused.
You win at poker?
1,000, I said. I mean, 10 bucks. 1,000 pennies.
Might as well be dollars. Nothing to spend it on.
Interesting thing for him to say. You could buy stuff when we stop at the Hilton.
Yeah, but you couldn't carry it with you, unless you have less than 10 kilograms.
Maybe I should have saved a few ounces. Bring back an Orbit Hilton t-shirt. Be the only one on the block. The pilot, Collins, sat down next to Barry.
Thrills and chills, he said. Routine stuff, right?
Barry said. He paused a moment and said,
Sure.
You've seen this happen before? I said.
In fact, no, but I haven't ridden the elevator that many times.
He looked past me to where Dr. Porter was doing mysterious things with the controls. Paul, you're more scared than I am. He settled back into the chair, as if trying to look relaxed.
I'm just not used to not being in control. This is routine, he said to Barry. It's just not my routine. I'm sure Porter has everything under control.
His face said that he wasn't sure. You are free to walk around now, Dr. Porter said, her head still hidden. I suppose pilots can walk around all they want. We'll be done here in less than an hour. You should be in your seats when we start up again. Barry relaxed a little at that and turned his attention back to dinner. Paul didn't relax. He stood up slowly and took the vial of white pills from his pocket. He shook out 2 into his hand and headed for the galley to pick up a squeeze bottle of water. He took the pills and went back to his seat. Barry hadn't seen that, his back to the galley.
You're not eating, he said.
Yeah. I took a small bite of the beef, but it was like chewing on cardboard. Hard to swallow. You know, I'm not all that hungry. I'll save it for later. I pressed the plastic back down over the top and went over to the galley. The refrigerator wouldn't open. Not keyed to my thumbprint. So I took the plate and a bottle of water back down to my seat. Card was reading a magazine.
That food?
Mine, El Morano. Wait your turn. I slid it under my seat but kept the water bottle. The pilot had taken 2 pills. I took 3.
What, you scared?
Good time to take a nap. I resisted telling him that if the Mars pilot was scared, I could be scared too, thank you very much. I pulled the light blanket over me. It fastened automatically on the other side, a kind of loose cocoon for 0G. I reached for the VR helmet, but it was locked. A little red light glowing. Making sure everyone could hear emergency announcements, I supposed. Like, the ribbon has broken. Everybody take a deep breath and pray like hell. After about a minute, the pills were starting to drag my eyelids down, even though the anxiety, adrenaline, was trying to keep me awake. Finally, the pills won. I had a nightmare, but it wasn't about the elevator. I was with Elspeth, and we were working alongside her parents in the aftermath of Gehenna. Whoever caused Gehenna had started it years before, by contaminating the water supplies of Tel Aviv and Haifa. People who had lived in those cities even for a few days became carriers of the Azazel, an initially harmless nanoorganism that migrated to the lungs, to wait. It wasn't even organic, just a sub-microscopic machine. Then the second part came. 1 minute after the beginning of Passover, 13 bombs exploded simultaneously in Tel Aviv and Haifa and their suburbs. They were relatively small explosions, with a lot of smoke. It was a windy day, and the vapor from the bombs spread quickly. They called it a coadjuvant reaction, which sounds cozy. Dust from the bombs activated the Azazels. People's lungs stopped working. They could breathe in, but couldn't breathe out.
Respirators could delay death
for the ones who were already in hospitals.
2 million others were dead in minutes. So in my dream, Elspeth and I went from one rigid, rotting corpse to another, collecting identification tags. Behind us was heavy machinery, digging a trench. Mass burial was against Jewish law, or custom, but the smell was unbearable.